How do I start this one? Forget.
Hey, everybody. I'm
Yeah, I know, because we've been doing Spotcast every week, so I've got the Spotcasting in my head.
Yeah, that has a different style. And episode 319.
So how do I say it? Hey, everybody, welcome to this is More Than Just Cool. How do I say this? I don't know. It's going to sound weird. All right.
Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 319 of the More Than Just Code podcast.
Thank you. Okay,
got it. That sounds about right.
All right. All right, hey everybody, welcome to episode 319 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitcher and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Haim Olympus Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we have Mark Rubin on the line in San Jose, California.
Hello. All right. But Tim, I got to say you did it wrong.
Why?
Because you did it right.
There was no burner one in there for those of you who
I'm a professional
in the recording here.
What are you saying, Haim?
I'm saying for those of you who don't participate in the recording, there's usually like a burner one, you know,
one burner
you gotta warm up a little bit, you know, just take the top one off and then just throw it away and then just use the next one after.
Yeah, but then I also do some editing, so they don't hear the second take and the third take. Sometimes I say hi.
Well, that's why he's explaining it.
Yeah, because I know.
I guess we assume they don't know.
That's true. I've published a few of those thingies. Anyway, so let's dig in. Do we have any fact check? I can't even remember. It's been so long, right?
You know, the if you didn't figure it out yourself. It probably wasn't that important. Is what I would say to the listeners. Like if there wasn't some burning fact that we got wrong, then it's okay. Yeah. The statute of limitations has expired on these.
All right. Well, speaking of that, do we have any Ask MTJC, homie?
We do. We have one from a longtime friend of the show, Sean Marston. Interested to know if you guys have discovered this quote non-3D touch issue with new Apple iPhone 12 issue. And etc. It is far too easy to inadvertently put the torch or flash, if you prefer, when pulling it out of a pocket. And I would say, yes, I have done that and said, why? Oh, that's right, because it doesn't do 3D touch anymore. I don't have to sort of give it some force. It just, you know, does a long press timer. And depending how I pull that out of my pocket, I've definitely had the flashlight just beam me right in the face.
Oh, really? Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I'm fumbling here in my hand with a new Pro, 12 Pro, but it's still in the box, even though I have used it and did a build to it. But yeah, it belongs to the company, and but I don't leave it on because I want to keep the battery. So yeah, I was going to try it out, but I got to fire it up. But I haven't really sort of walked around with it much, right? So
yeah, I'm the same way. I haven't had the problem, but I don't actually put it in my pocket much and walk around with it
right
these days since I never leave the house.
But the 3D touch thing is, or so I guess the issue is that the older phones still have the mechanism for 3D touch. Is that what the deal is?
No, so I haven't gotten a new phone, and I guess spoilers, we're going to talk about new phones later this episode. With the old iPhone 10 that I used to have, I would almost never accidentally turn on the camera or accidentally turn on the flashlight from the lock screen, because you sort of had to give it a little bit of oomph to get it to trigger, right? It's the way the 3D touch worked. But now that they removed that out of iOS 14 and certainly don't have the hardware, I believe, in the new iPhones, it's just, as far as I can tell, just a long press. So yes, it's entirely possible that, you know, as I put my hand on my phone to get it out of my pocket, I might have been, you know, touching the corner and is like, oh, I feel a thumb there. Great. That's long enough to trigger the action and fire off the flashlight or the camera.
Yeah. So I got to say that it must be a hardware thing, because I have in my hand an iPhone XS, and when I press down on I feel a haptic like click when I do it. But if I just tap if I'm sitting here and tapping right now, I'm just tapping, you can't hear it, but I'm tapping my thumb on the screen and nothing's happening, but I have to actually hold it or press it or whatever. But I do feel a haptic feedback when I do that, right? So,
well, yeah, Force Touch definitely was a hardware thing that they've turned off.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, like, I'm running 14.1 on my personal phone, but it's not doing the thing that Sean's saying his is doing, right? So, because he's got the new shiny iPhone 12, I guess.
Right.
The 12's out already?
Yep.
iPhone 12.
Yeah. And no pre-orders happened.
Oh, as opposed to the Pro? Or
the Pro 12 order, the regular size 12 was a pre-order, like, a couple end of October, right? Mm-hmm. And then, because I just got mine, like, last week. which is beginning of November, and then I think the 12 itself and the mini were like a week or two later for the pre-orders, right, Jaime? And
I think it was a couple weeks, maybe almost 3 weeks difference, because I was surprised when people said, oh yeah, like the minis and maxes are in pre-order. I'm like, what, really? Barely? You know? So I suppose that they're making their way out there. Yeah, I mean, I got my phone like right away, so I had no troubles this year.
You have a Pro or a 12 Pro or 12 Pro Max?
I got the 12 Pro.
Okay.
So we'll definitely talk about thoughts about those things.
Those were available. Those were the first pre-order, but the Max and the Mini, I think they just came out last week, if not already. Let me just see here. I'm just going to go and see what's on pre-order. If I go to a 12, it looks like I can buy them now. I got to say, so I bought Carol a red watch 6, right? Not that she needed a watch. She didn't. She just likes the red. And so we got her that one. But I wanted to buy it with the solo braided loop, right? And I ordered it from the get-go. I couldn't order it with the loop. Like, I couldn't order the braided loop on day one. And of course, her birthday wasn't until last week. So the 14-day, return it if you don't like it kind of thing had already expired. So I'm stuck, not stuck, but she has a red sport band. What do you call this sport? The one where it wraps with the Velcro sport band or whatever. Anyway, but yeah, it kind of annoyed me that I couldn't order the loop right from the get-go. I would have waited like a week or two. Like, I'm not, should have let me pre-order it. What are you going to do? All right, so this next one is PSA. It's kind of stale. I think I posted this back in September, so it may still be happening, but this was a weird thing that was happening where you might have gotten a message from saying something from Google Syndication, wanted to download an application to your phone or to your Mac, and this was something related to, Apple's done this now with most of the things you download from a site for the first time. It asks you if you want to allow downloads from them, and it's part of the privacy thing, but for some reason, this one particular, there was a rogue ad that had gotten out that had a download in it. And Apple's privacy setting was catching this. And I hopefully by now, Google has updated this. What's the date on this post? Yeah, September 23rd. It's pretty stale. But yeah, it was just sort of a PSA. And there's a tip here on how you can go in and stop it. And what you had to do was actually set your setting to deny without allowing, having sites ask you if you want to download things. So that was sort of a weird thing. It happened to me a few times. I think one of you guys mentioned it on Slack. I don't know if you remember or not, like a month ago. No,
that wasn't me.
Yeah, it wasn't me because I'm not using Safari. So
right, okay. Well, and so this is another one too. We've talked about in the past the trials and tribulations, as Jaime likes to say, the fact that I'm sort of the test subject because on the podcast, because I still run with two Apple IDs, right? One for iCloud, and which is my old .Mac mobile me account, and my iTunes account is on a different Apple ID, right? And so I've had to add both of those to a family account along with Carol and stuff like that, so I can have my cake and eat it too. And we were looking forward to Apple One, which is basically a way to get bundled services instead of separate services. Like, I pay separately for iCloud now and music, and I was trying Arcade, and there's one other thing which I'm forgetting now, News, I think. Last Friday, Apple rolled out the Apple One, so you could right away. So if you didn't know that yet, this may be news to you, but you can actually sign up for Apple One now. But one of the things I noticed in reading through the documentation is that when you sign up for Apple One, you can choose which of your multiple Apple IDs will become the primary one, which is the big problem that I've had for the last 10 years or 5 years or whatever, is that Apple wouldn't consolidate my two Apple IDs into one, right? For whatever reason. But I guess, their old COBOL archive or COBOL database doesn't work to do that. But and I'm only being partially facetious on that. But the fact that now that I can choose the one Apple ID that I want to be my primary, hopefully will take over my family account, hopefully will take over all my Apple services under one umbrella. So looking forward to that. So that's something that's interesting. And I've asked some of our buddies on the MTJC Slack about their experiences. And one of them said that he's already done this. He did a thing where he was able to consolidate his accounts into one Apple ID, which is good. All right. Next one. Yeah, and this is another one. This came up with us at work. I think we talked about this before, that Apple changed the privacy setting. They do this every iteration of iOS, at least, right? Where they change the privacy requirements. And I think we talked about this at during the WWDC stuff, that they had changed the requirements for privacy settings in the metadata on your app, not necessarily in the app itself. I mean, you still have to do all the camera and calendar and all that kind of stuff. But they're asking that you have all your metadata privacy strings and whatever in your account before you try it, before December 8th, which is coming up quick, right? Because it's like a month away from now, you know, 3-4 weeks to get all your privacy stuff. And there's a link here. This is from the Apple News site. And there's a link here on the details and what they're asking for, if you follow that link through to see what they're asking about. Like things like data collection, like if you're collecting data for Google Analytics or whatever, just like websites, you have to sort of acknowledge that kind of stuff. The kind of data that you're collecting, name, address, email address, phone numbers, you know, shipping addresses, that kind of thing, payment information, you know, location. Of course, this new location setting in iOS 14 takes effect now, because now you can have sort of an approximate location or precise location. Previously, you know, an app could tell where you were, like within a geofence, but now they can only sort of approximate. They're not allowed to, if you opt out of letting them know exactly where you are, they'll kind of suggest there's a Starbucks near you, kind of thing. And other things that you might
want. Well, there's always a Starbucks near you, so that's
easy. So it's kind of a bad example. That's true. But just sort of information like diagnostics, logs, that kind of stuff. Like, I think, you know, as developers, we hope that our users will opt into the sending us information on the crashes, so we can, you know, get the bug logs from Apple, or the crash logs from Apple, and fix up our software. But yeah, just, you know, interesting stuff that they've added into this thing. And of course, you know, like I said, December 8th is currently the deadline for getting this stuff in. And I think this article was posted, November 5th, like last week. So not a lot of notice, but we have talked about this, haven't we, before? You guys remember?
It was the, like, nutrition label thing is what I remember.
Yeah, right.
Like, I don't know if people have these in their countries, but for those who don't know, in the United States, at the very least, like, which is what I can speak to, if you buy a can of chicken soup, it will show you a nutrition label on the back that, one, sort of verifies that, yes, the ingredients at least vaguely include chicken as part of the requirements, but also tells you, like, you know, this has 10% of your daily intake of iron and probably 35% of your daily intake of sodium, and et cetera, et cetera. I think that's what this was sort of modeled for, as I remember, if this is the correct privacy thing we're talking about.
Yeah,
kind of exactly. A nutrition label for what is it that this app does with my data.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I noticed even in Overcast that they're now posting in there, and this may be part of this thing that, you know, we host our website or podcast with Fireside, and Fireside has some, you know, stats collection that they do. So, you know, if you go to More Than Just Code and you click on if you go into Overcast and you swipe to the right, you'll see a sort of statement about the fact that we're with Fireside, and that, and we didn't publish this, Fireside did, right? And then, or maybe Overcast did, and then it shows, you know, what stats collection they use to do with that service. So that's an example of something if you wanted to go and look at it today, kind of thing. But that's the kind of information that Apple's looking for us to be transparent about. All right. So Jaime, you're up with Roku.
Yeah, I actually just tested this out just a little bit right before this very show. So apparently the Roku devices, or at least some subset of them, are getting AirPlay 2 and apparently HomeKit, but I don't have any HomeKit devices. Can't test that. But I did test out AirPlay 2 and it looks like it works pretty well. I was able to mirror my screen. I didn't try pushing it hard with anything like serving a video or anything, but It works just like I would expect it to work with an Apple TV. So that was pretty nice.
So you can, if you're watching a video on your phone, you can push it up to the Roku kind of idea, right?
Yeah. So this was one of the things that when I went down the Roku path, which longtime fans of the show know that there's a tangled and convoluted path that the original reasons for going down this route are no longer valid business reasons. And the one last holdout was, oh yeah, maybe I could get an Apple TV once this Roku device dies, because the thing I can't do is integrate with AirPlay, but no longer. So now they're functionally similar for my use case. And I think this really plays into Apple's sort of opening things up more in its ecosystem, given that it's fo- focusing more on services like Apple One, Apple.
So do you, so your Roku device is an old, like it's in your TV or something like that, right? Or you have a hardware Roku?
I have a hardware Roku. It's like a little little brick. The older one used to be closer to like a hockey puck size, but this one is, you know, more like a small little box, and it has that connected to the TV, which the TV is just a dumb TV.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Or at least I treat it like a dumb monitor. If it has smart TV capabilities, we never used it. So.
Right. Yeah. I have a Roku here too, but I've never actually plugged it in. My mother has a Roku in her house. That's just why I got one and set up an account so I could see what's going on with it. Have to support it, of course. Right. So the Roku that you currently have is an older one, and you're able to take advantage of this new service. So it's like a software update kind of thing, or?
Yeah, it's not the latest and greatest Roku Premier. It's at least 1 year, maybe 2 years behind. I'm not sure how long ago I got it. But apparently it qualified for the compatibility with this update.
Right.
I suddenly saw that my Roku was an AirPlay receivable device when I was looking at my phone. It's like, oh, I guess this article applies to me. Great. I can talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Well, speaking of old posts, this is one from September 2. So what do you got here, Rami?
Yeah, and in the interest of getting Apple's software and other things onto other ecosystems, this is a post from Swift.org talking about Swift on Windows.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bringing that there. So not a ton to say here. It looks like it's the very beginnings, but you know, nice to see that Swift can be used outside of other contexts. But certainly, we've talked about doing things on server side, but you know, expanding the base to include Windows users, it just adds more people to the language community, nothing else.
Right. So what does this do for somebody on Windows? Lets them build a little app or whatever? Or?
Yeah, they show like a little calculator app type example. I don't know the particulars and what the limitations are. I mean, folks might remember that server-side Swift didn't have one-to-one parity with things you might do on Mac OS or iOS, given that a lot of the foundation pieces had to be, like literal foundation, had to be re-implemented to run on other operating systems and not make use of underlying libraries and frameworks that were baked into iOS and Mac OS. So I don't know the details for the Windows side, but I would just assume that you probably will have it. So if you're like really excited, like, oh, now my Swift UI project can just run on Windows, like probably not, but possibly in the future, maybe, you know, keep your hopes up and maybe it'll happen. Or, you know, pull requests accepted, I'm pretty sure. So maybe you can be the change that you want to see in the world.
Right, right. So yeah, while we were away, we were on break here. It was a couple of events, I think, that the iPhone event happened while we were on break, right? The new iPhones that came out?
It did.
So, as we were sort of saying earlier in the show, by now, you know, we have a new iPhone 12, iPhone 12 Pro, iPhone 12 Pro Max, iPhone Mini, which is a smaller version of the iPhone, still not as small as an SE, I believe, right? And as well a HomePod Mini, right? Which I think that's sort of, somebody asked about. I think on our Slack channel, they asked if we could talk about our individual purchases for this stuff. So why don't we just sort of cover off? How do you want to do this iPhone stuff here? One post that I put here as a sort of talking point is that somebody's done a side by side screenshot of or photograph of the iPhone 11 Pro and the iPhone 12 Pro Max. Sorry, are they both Maxes? I guess yeah, they're both Pro Maxes. So the 11 Pro Max and the 12 Pro Max. The 11 is a 6.5 inch diagonal screen and diagonally measured, and the 12 is 6.7. So it's bigger, but it's obviously, you know, in the side by side picture, you can see quite a bit how much bigger it is. I think proportionally the notch seems to be smaller. You have a Pro, right, Jaime? Just a regular Pro?
I have the 12 Pro. That's right.
Yeah. Did you notice that the notch is a little bit smaller than the 10 and the 10S?
I guess. I mean, I didn't scientifically compare this and do measurements with my 10 to compare. I suppose like the screen definitely is noted. It jumps right out at me, like how much bigger it is compared to the iPhone 10. And the device itself is definitely noticeably bigger. So I'm kind of not surprised that the 11 Pro Max and the 12 Pro Max would seem different as well. I imagine it'd be just as noticeable to you if you upgraded from one to the other.
Yeah, actually just turning on this Pro, the 12 Pro that I have in my hand. You know, it doesn't look that much different. I mean, the width of the earpiece is narrower, and of course, it's got the metal edges like the 4 and 5, right?
Yeah.
With the antenna brakes in it.
Looking at the picture, it looks like the physical size of the notch is actually the same on both devices, but because the screen is bigger on the 12 Pro Max, the notch looks relatively small.
Looks a little candy box that this phone comes in, right? Without the power. That was a big. I think we talked about this before. Was the fact that we were anticipating that wasn't going to be a power brick inside. What else?
And we were right.
And the earphones, or we don't have the earphones. So it only comes with a power. No, there is no power brick. It's basically a USB cable, USB C cable to Lightning.
The Lightning. That's it.
Yeah, and then and the phone itself, right? So and paper, like a paper box, and a much smaller box too. Like no plastic in the box at all. So which Apple's been moving towards, sort of more environmental packaging. I know it's in my iPad Pro and my Mac that I got this year was all sort of paper-based, cardboard-based stuff, no plastic in the packaging at all, which is cool. So yeah, what do you want to talk about with these phones? Did you order a phone, Mark?
I did. I got a 12 Pro.
Okay, so we all have Pros, 12 Pros. Nobody decided to go with Max this year?
No, I never go with the Max. I think they're just, for me, they're just too big.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had the Max 6 Max and it didn't enjoy it at all. What about you, Jaime? You had a Max?
Yeah, I considered going the Max size because I had previously had the 6 Plus and the 7 Plus, and those were really kind of nice for the time. It was sort of like having as close as you could get to an iPad in your pocket as you might reasonably get without it being a foldable phone. And it was actually pretty useful when I was working in an office as an iOS engineer and say, hey, I've got this idea, and you could show somebody and they didn't have to squint. Like they could see it from the other side of the room, right? In a conference room. Working from home, I'm like, well, that's kind of less interesting as a parlor trick. And I've enjoyed the very nice pocketability of the iPhone X, and this device is noticeably larger, but not weirdly or obsessively so. So it seemed like a good fit for me. And I think if I had gone the Max, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed the lack of pocket space that it would incur. But I mean, the downside is I don't have the fancy pants camera setup that the Max has this year, right? So there's some trade-offs there.
But is there a difference? Does the Max have that much of a difference in camera? That was the same camera.
I don't believe it is literally the same. I believe this is one of those years where there is a difference. I don't recall what the difference
really
is.
Really? Okay.
But I mean, they were all really close this year. I think if you wanted something smaller, like an iPhone SE, or at least closer to it, I think the iPhone 12 mini is probably a pretty good choice for folks.
Right. Yeah. But it's still bigger than an SE though, right?
Mini, I believe it is.
Yeah.
I believe the mini is similar to like a iPhone 8. Isn't it?
The pixel size is different, obviously, because we're going from 6.1 to 6.7. So it's almost a full inch there. But I guess it would be like a half inch tall. I'm just looking here. Camera. Nope. Identical cameras, I mean. They have the same camera.
I thought there was some difference with the Max this year. Like I know last year there was no.
Oh, sorry. The aperture. You're right. The aperture is different. But yeah, usually they do side-by-side numbers. But yeah, they've got one paragraph here for the cameras. They both have 12 megapixel. Ultra wide is 2.4, aperture wide is 1.6. The aperture, the lower the number, the aperture, the more light you can get into your lens and, get a lower light shot in focus. So the iPhone 12 Max has a larger aperture. It's 2.2 as opposed to 2.0 between the 12 Pro. They both have the same optical and digital zooms. Oh, sorry, 5x optical zoom range on the Max. That's another advantage. Yeah, so it is slightly different. But in terms of the megapixels of the camera and that kind of stuff, they're essentially the same. And they both have LiDAR now, right? They have a LiDAR camera?
I believe they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, I like it. I haven't really pushed the camera in any reasonable way. I mean, I guess I could turn down the lights and try out night mode in my own house, but being quarantine locked down, at least just staying home during the pandemic, I haven't had the at the bar with friends sort of field test that would normally happen with these sorts of night modes. I'm pretty satisfied with it as a phone. I do think, as much as there are nice things about the new squared off edges of the phone, reminiscent of the iPhone 4, while there is something better in gripability, I don't believe this will slide off of your desk, as an example, Tim, which was a problem with the 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's 10. It was like a bar of soap, apparently. But I do feel like this is less elegant of
really?
A design.
Oh, I like the square edges myself.
I feel like it's like more functional, but clunkier in how it feels to me, going from directly from the 10 to...
Well, there's no curved glass anymore, right? Like, they had to have curved glass on the previous models, right? On the edges, the edge of the glass is curved, but here it's just flat, right?
I get what you mean. I mean, it kind of has more of an industrial feel, right? As opposed to a luxury feel. I know what you mean, but I kind of like it. You know?
Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad. It's more, and I think, Tim, you're talking about, like, there are very many objective reasons why this is better than the device that I gave up.
Yeah.
But just the feel of it just seems less elegant, and that's a very, very subjective sort of thing, and it might just be a me thing, right?
Well, it's more Bauhaus than Art Nouveau, if you know what I'm saying.
Does this qualify as a brutalist thing? I see brutalist thrown around a lot.
It's industrial. It's sort of industrial would be the right way to say it, or steampunk, I guess, too. So here's a question for you guys.
For steampunk, you'd need to have a Zeppelin attached to it.
Or some leather on it. Yeah, for sure. The question for you, I mean, notwithstanding we're all sitting at home and we're like, you know, hiding away from the coronavirus, the 5G, have you guys noticed any difference in service, cell service or speed or whatever?
I can't say anything because I actually haven't activated my cellular yet.
Oh, really? What?
Yeah, I know. Long story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got the phone, but it just doesn't work as a phone yet.
Oh, so you're using it as a big iPod.
Exactly. Yeah. I will do that soon enough.
The iPod 12. How about you, Hami?
Yeah, I haven't seen the various forms of 5G. Like, I have been connected to 5G, but on Verizon, they have like 5G and then 5G slightly gooder and then 5G ultra wideband, which I think is the best on Verizon. I do not believe there is any of the ultra wideband stuff anywhere even vaguely close to me. So the little window that it has, for those of you who have American models, it's got a little window on the side where all the 5G goodness penetrates through, apparently.
Oh, right. Right.
I've not taken advantage of that because I don't think they have it here in the Seattle area. I have been connected to what I believe is the baseline 5G. It seems approximately the same as LTE. I don't know. Maybe it's kind of like a more consistently high download rate LTE, instead of being kind of sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not, depending on the rain sort of thing with Verizon. So I think this, from a, like if 5G was going to be your make or break, I wouldn't necessarily buy the phone just for that. Look at it as more of, if you're going to hang onto this phone for a few years, it's probably a pretty decent investment that you don't get left behind and be like, oh no, my phone sucks because it only has LTE. it just isn't, as far as I can tell, again, from the Seattle area, I can't tell that it's been useful for me, but I also don't live like in the downtown area. So maybe they have the towers up there or something.
Right. Interesting. So yeah, I forgot about that. You got that little glass antenna on the side, right? For your 5G?
I don't know. It was a glass. I never actually tried.
Well, you said glass. I don't know. We don't have the
little, I call it a window because it's like, they clearly had to machine a little hole for the metal, but I don't know if this is like
there's something in there like plastic or whatever, right?
Yeah. Some non-metal plug is there in the, on the side. It's about the same size.
So I'm looking at the Canadian site because I was just, while you guys were talking, there's like a gazillion different configurations of, you know, GSM and Edge and whatever, and LTEs and 5Gs and whatever. It's like there's a hodgepodge of things, too much to go into. But it does say here at the bottom, there's a link. Maybe I'll put a link in the show notes, as to identify your model number. Head over to this link to check it out for details on 5G and LTE support. Because as you were saying, and as I realized I was on the Canadian side, I wonder, because it's got model numbers here for me. It's got like model A2406 and A2410. And they have different kind of configurations for their service. Yeah, the model numbers are different in the US than they are in Canada. So you're 2341 and 2342, did I just say? Yeah, so clearly there's like different configurations of these actual phones based on where they're being sold, right? So like you've got AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon, and of course we're Rogers, Bell, and doesn't even say who we are here in Canada on the website. But yeah, so that's interesting, the fact that there's another digital divide between us, I guess, right?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why. I guess at scales that iPhones are made, maybe it made sense to not not make all the phones exactly the same. I'm a little unclear why the American one is different versus, oh, well, if the American one needs to support this, let's just go ahead and make all of the phones like that. And yes, it won't be active in your particular country, but it means we save on variability. I guess maybe the cost of
If that thing, whatever that thing is an expensive thing, then it might make sense to be that.
Well, there's also regionalization and you know, like you have to get, like we have a federal standards something or other that looks at radios and stuff like that in our phones and or devices, including computers. And you guys have a different set of standards, you know, for safety and whatever and compliance and stuff. And I do know that Macs and sold in Canada and US are different too, right? I mean, like they're essentially the same, but I think the licensing is different, right? Like my serial numbers all start with the letter C. What's your serial number on your Mac start with there? Just out of curiosity.
On the Mac?
Yeah. You know, if you go to Mac.
It starts with C.
Does it? Yeah, oh, okay. C is in Charlie.
C zero something?
Okay. Charlie 02 Z.
Yeah, there goes that theory, right?
Wait, you have a Canadian version, Tommy? With a Z?
No. Yeah, right.
It's slow because of all these superfluous U's in there. I'm actually looking at one of Apple's support things. So I've only ever seen the 5G icon in my status bar. It looks like, I think maybe 5G Plus might be AT&T's. And then 5G UW is only, it's the millimeter wave one that's only in certain areas. And I definitely have not seen either of those other icons in there.
Hmm.
Traffic's back enough to normal that I don't think I want to do like a little road trip just to try this out and see, because it would just be a very, very long commute.
Yeah. Well, you can always turn your Wi-Fi off and check out your LTE, right? Or your feed.
Well, I know that here in my little area, I don't, you know, I've never seen anything other than the normal 5G icon. And maybe if I went closer to like CenturyLink Field or something, maybe I'd be able to see it. But
I see what you mean. Like it's visually a different thing. Like I think mine probably says LTE on it. It doesn't say anything on mine.
Yeah, I have seen it drop to LTE when it was raining pretty hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I do know the icon changes, but I've never seen it go to the 5G UW.
All right. Cool.
Yeah, maybe I'll throw that link in the show notes so you can see what I'm talking about.
So I guess the next question, since we're going to the next article, did you guys get the MagSafe adapter for your phones or the MagSafe cases?
I did not.
No.
So the lead in here is that Apple has launched, this is on November 7th last week, it launched an iPhone 12 Studio where you can mix and match cases and different kind of things to try and configure the correct, you know, the best optimal case and, you know, whether you want to have like cards carried on the back. Because Apple has a bunch of MagSafe, wallet attachments that go on the back of your phone, different, you know, leathers and stuff like that that you can try out. So, which is kind of cool. So the iPhone 12 Studio, they're calling it, to go and mix and match. And I guess like if you're so inclined to have a different watch band for every day of the week, you may have a different, you know, MagSafe case for every day of the week, I guess, right? You guys haven't thought about, you know, what you would do like in terms of getting a different case or different configuration, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I haven't thought that far ahead. You know, so again, I leave the house so rarely these days.
Yeah.
I don't really think about having to put the phone in a case or anything like that. I will at some point.
So was your motivation for getting a new phone because you were on the plan or because you needed a phone for development? Or
honestly, I hadn't bought a new phone in a while and I just had the itch. my plan expired a long time ago, so you know, that wasn't really anything for me, and I don't need it. I don't necessarily need the latest and greatest for development these days.
Right.
But you know, I was still carrying around the same iPhone 10 for years,
So
I figured it was time.
Sure. It's funny because Paul Hudson was saying on Twitter, I don't know if it's been resolved by now, but he's on a plan in the UK and he can't get the phone because the stores aren't open, right? So he can't go. They won't send him a phone. He has to be able to go in person and get it. And for some reason, so it's kind of weird. They're happy to take his money, but they can't get him a new phone. So I don't know if that's been resolved or not, but that was something he was talking about on Twitter a couple of days ago, that kind of stuff. So that's cool.
Yeah. The confusion around whether I would need to be in person at a store in order to do the iPhone upgrade program, which I am not on, made me say, whatever, I'll just buy the phone. I'll get Apple Care. And next year I can deal with this, presuming that we would have a post-COVID world at that point. So I did not buy a case, not necessarily because I work from home or stay home a lot, but because I've been been going caseless since the iPhone 5. My iPhone in his birthday suit. I did consider getting the little like wallet thingy on. I'm like, oh, okay, that could be kind of useful. I might just want to run out with just my phone and my watch and you know, one or two cards with me. I didn't go that route, and I didn't get the MagSafe charger because I have a Nanami
key, yeah,
charger that works pretty well. I have it on my desk. I obviously it doesn't do fast charging, but not usually in a rush to charge stuff. And if I ever was, I did actually buy the power brick, the, what is it, 20 watt USB-C power brick for my phone, since it did not come in the box.
All right.
I'll be prepared for next year when the 100% recycled brown paper bag is what my iPhone arrives in.
All right.
It won't even come in a box. It'll just be digitally downloaded. It'll be a virtual phone.
Yeah.
That you can just download.
Yeah. You print it on your 3D printer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, so this week, just on Tuesday, you know, we've all been talking about the Apple Silicon chips and stuff like that coming. And we were anticipating that the one more thing event that they had this on Tuesday was supposed to roll out what are going to be the first iterations of these Macs. I mean, the DTK has I think it's an A12 chip in there, the little Mac minis that we all got at WWDC, or some of us got at WWDC, to play around with it. But now you can order, this was rolled out at the event on Tuesday. Tim Cook and team, I made some notes of the names, some of the names of the people, they announced the first Mac is going to be a MacBook Air, which is kind of cool. And as a MacBook Air, I've been using MacBook Air since they first came out. This year I went back to the MacBook Pro 13 because they're practically the same size. And there was a couple of things that I could get more disk and I could get more RAM in a Pro than I could in a MacBook Air. Plus it has four USB ports. So that's why I went with the 2020 Touch Bar MacBook Pro that I have now. But John Ternus was introducing the new MacBook Air design, and it's pretty slick looking thing. I mean, you know, the I guess we can talk about the chip itself, I guess, Mark, right? With the whole system on a chip, RAM and GPU, and right inside the CPU, right?
Yeah, the chip looks pretty hot. It's got all sorts of cores. It's got those high performance cores, and it's got those, you know, lower performance but sort of everyday kind of cores. And presumably iOS is smart enough to know which to do where. And that's in addition to the GPU cores that are off on the other side of this of the thing. I mean, there's no surprise to me that this thing is blazing fast. I mean, there's a lot of power on that thing.
There's no bus to go across. It's just running across the 5-nanometer design buses, right, or transistors, right?
That helps. Yep, that helps.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool looking thing. And so this is the M1 chip that we're talking about, which is the first iteration. We got three Macs. I mean, basically the Mac Mini as well as the MacBook Pro 13 2-port version, not the 4-port. That's coming later, I would think. What do you guys think about it?
I think I'm going to get one. I still haven't decided which one yet. I think I've ruled out the Pro.
Yeah.
For the simple reason that I think I'm going to invest in a high-end Pro when they're available.
Right.
But they're not available yet. But I do need something sort of as a stopgap, because my wonderful MacBook Pro 15-inch 2013 is seeing, you know, it's seeing better
long
days.
Long in the tooth, yeah.
You know? Yeah. So I got to get something. And so I'm really kind of torn between a Mini and the Air. I think I may be, actually, this may surprise you, leaning towards the Mini.
Really?
Because I am viewing it as a stopgap that I can use later for, like, you know, if I want to use it as a server or something like that later on. So if in a year or so I buy a nice fancy laptop, then I won't have this, like, still nice but not as useful laptop that I invested in just a year before.
Yeah, funny.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
I mean, I have a couple of Minis too. Well, I have three technically, because I have the DTK here as well. But and I use them primarily for backups and stuff like that, and for serving media and things like that. But and it's a funny story is my 2010 MacBook Air came home 2 weeks ago. So I've now got, and along with the second one, so I've got a 2010, a 2012, and two 2013s now in the house, and like, just, you know, I'm rich with MacBook Airs. But you know, I think for the same reasons that I went with the MacBook Pro this year, right? in the 2020 track bar version. I mean, that was another condition. Another thing for me was the Pro has a track bar as well, and I am a track bar fan. I would probably
touch
go with
bar. You mean right?
Touch bar? Yeah. They all have track bars. Touch bar. I mean, from a performance point of view, they're very similar. But I mean, what I like about the Air though is the portability, right? So like the fact that I can sit on the couch and tool around with it. But like I said, I've got tons of MacBook Airs around my house right now. So
right, and part of this decision is because of my work style. Is I always use a wireless keyboard and a wireless trackpad.
And closed lid, right?
And I keep the lid closed all the time. Yeah. So then there's the question, well, do I want it to be portable in terms of going out and about? And it's the same argument. Well, if in a year I'm going to buy a new laptop, probably in the next year, I'm not going to be out and about all that much if things continue going the way they're going. So these all are sort of pointing me in that direction.
So it's basically a desktop Mac. I mean, like with the monitor you have now, you have a 5K monitor, right? So you basically, it's like having, we're not even talking about iMacs, right? Like in this conversation, like I don't think any of us, I mean, I have an iMac here at the house, but we rarely use it anymore. Because I mean, I guess that would be the next sort of, I think the next version to try and get out there and get on the market would be an iMac for Apple, right? Because I don't know if would they go with the Pros in the next iteration? I don't know. Like they might.
Right. Why not?
Like, I mean, maybe in December they'll come out with an iMac to try and get the Christmas sales, right? I mean, like the thing about it is like, I guess.
December of this year, not this year.
This year.
Oh, you think they'll do an
iMac? Yeah, pretty quick. I mean, how long would it take to do an iMac? Not very long, right? Essentially, right? What's to stop them from putting like, or are they just going to not skip over the iMac, right? Because essentially it's a monitor with stuff in it, right? So,
You know? Well, I don't think it would be particularly hard for them to do it, but I sort of think they would have announced it all in the same announcement if they were going to, don't you think?
Yeah,
you think
I don't know. I think
another announcement?
I think the Mini and the Air makes sense from the point of view of it's a first step, right? I think they probably needed to do a Pro for marketing reasons because, you know, the MacBook, I think they said the 13 Pro is the most popular Mac that they sell, right? So, because I mean, even when the Touch Bar first came out, they still had the Function Key version, right? And that was still selling quite well, right? So I think the low-end MacBook Pro is probably a student machine, you know, like for education, for colleges and high school, right? And I'm trying to think, I can't really think of any reason. I did post here in the link, we should probably look at that. I got the side-by-side links of all three, because I think the Pro and the Air are very close together in terms of configuration, right? Battery life is 2 hour different. The Touch Bar, the difference is Touch Bar on the Pro versus no Touch Bar on the Air. The chip is the same on all three of them. Same memory configurations. Yeah, 16 gigabytes upper limit on the memory. I think that's a showstopper for a lot of people. But storage, all three have the same storage capabilities. You can go up to 2 terabyte. Mm-hmm. Start with 256, go up to 2 terabyte. The display is virtually identical between the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro 13, except for the 13 has a slightly brighter display. And then just the size, right? Everything else is pretty much...
Oh, you mentioned stereo. Battery life? Did you mention battery life?
Well, the battery life is 2 hours different, so it's like 18... Yeah. They're claiming 18 hours on the Air and 20 hours on the Pro, right? But my thing... The thing about my the way I read these battery life things, it's like you turn it on and don't touch it.
right.
Mm-hmm. You know, use it, open up Xcode, all bets are off, right? I think the sound is different too. Yeah, so they've got slightly better sound in the Pro model. They're pretty much the same, right? So and of course with the Mini you don't get the keyboard and the trackpad. You have to buy those keyboard or mouse. You have to buy those separately, right? So what's the difference in price? They start at $699, I think. Minis.
Yeah, it's only a couple hundred bucks difference. Actually, it's not that much.
Oh, $899 Canadian.
Oh, the Mini to the Mini.
Yeah.
Oh, the Mini to the Air. Is, let's see, the high-end Mini starts at $899 base price, and the higher-end Air starts at, what, $1,299, is that right?
Yeah. What's the difference in price between the Air and the Pro?
That's the one that's only a couple hundred bucks. Surprising.
Oh, but you can get the Air in gold, though, Mark. That's the difference.
Oh, well, that's true.
And you know you want that gold Mac, right? Jaime, you've been quiet.
Yeah, because I won't be purchasing one. They do seem, I mean, just pretty fantastic. I have the 16-inch MacBook Pro that's actually slightly less than a year old. I'm like, I'm just going to ride this one into the ground. Or kind of like Mark, this might just be the stepping stone towards if something else comes out, you know, they're like, hey, this is a 32 gigabyte Pro. Maybe I'll jump onto that or something. It's not like I need to drop everything and go right into this. There will be a little bit of a transition period. I could just swoop in once everything has been sorted out. And that's just because I happen to have bitten the bullet and decided to upgrade my 2012 MacBook Pro, which was seeing its final days.
Right.
But it does seem really great. I was really, really shocked at how they said, like, oh, all these separate chips? Yeah, that's just one chip, one system on chip. And look at these stats that we're getting. And I also thought, like, well, you know, they could have waited until they had the 32 gigabyte capacity laptop, but they can always do next year the M2, the search for more money, like Spaceballs, and get people who thought that this wasn't enough. Great, we've got the second round. Here's more.
Yeah. By the way, for those of you yelling at your screens, there is a difference in the power supply. The battery on the Air is 49.9 watt hour, and the Pro is 58.2 watt hours. And of course, the Air comes with a 30 watt adapter, and the Pro comes with a 61 watt adapter. So, it says USB power port. What's the difference there? The Air not have any USB power? What's going on?
It has to, right?
Yeah, two USB. I guess you don't have as big a bag of dongles if you only have two ports, because one port's going to be using for power unless you pass through, right? Mm-hmm. So that's cool. So let's move on to the next story, which is courtesy of a couple people. Bev and Anderson on our MTJC Slack posted this, and another friend of mine just posted it as well, that somebody's already done a benchmark between the Apple Silicon M1 chip on the MacBook Air versus the high-end 16-inch MacBook Pro, and the Air comes out on top with the M1. Have you guys looked at this Geekbench score here?
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Geekbench 5.
I mean, that's one of the things where I know there's going to be weird hot takes out there of like, oh, it doesn't do better than this thing. It's like, well, I mean, they weren't replacing the entire Mac line here. In fact,
no.
The fact that they went with as many models as they did surprised me. I thought it'd be one version, like just the laptops or just, you know, like a desktop or something. And to get the Mini and the Pro in there really, really kind of surprised me. I'm like, oh, what the heck are they going to have available for an iMac or a Mac Pro in the future? I mean, it's going to be amazing given what they're already doing with this first iteration, first releases of stuff. Right, like it's
right.
It really makes you think, like, wow. So if you're Intel, what do you do well? I mean, it's like you had, you know, lost the battle in battery consumption long ago, or just never decided to fight it. And now it looks like they've pretty handily lost the power in terms of, you know, processing performance stats. So it's kind of interesting to see how, just not really out of nowhere, because if people have been listening to this show, you've certainly heard us talk about Apple's prowess in this. But for the normal person on the street, it was like, holy smokes, this thing is suddenly way better. Like, why is this laptop get half as much battery life as this other one? Oh, well, this one is the Apple Silicon. Oh, okay, cool. I guess I'll buy that.
Yeah, the one article we skipped over too was the Apple's M1 chip claiming to be the fastest laptop in the world. And according to independent studies, it turns out to be true, right? So did you have a look at this one, guys? This article from 9 to 5 Mac? Two links above on the show.
It's the same study though, isn't it?
Is it?
The Geekbench? Yeah.
Is it? Wait.
Yeah, I think it's just a different article talking about the same study.
This one that says detail and the tech says M1 chip is...
Well, maybe not, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, Apple was claiming throughout the whole thing, and they showed a few things, like they showed some charts and things like that, which were pretty vague in terms of there was no sort of metrics other than this is where they got to a certain threshold that, you know, Apple was here earlier in their little curve graph that they had there, you know, in terms of GPU performance and CPU performance versus Intel.
Yeah, but it's as a function of power. power, right? That's the important thing, mm-hmm. right? So for the same amount of power, you get way more performance. That's what they're showing.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true that they're not showing any actual labels on the y-axis, so what performance metrics are they actually using? However, if they're even close to being what they're showing in the plots, that's a pretty amazing difference. So yeah, it would be nice to see some actual values, but it looks pretty impressive, they're showing.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't done any side-by-side comparisons with the DTK and my current Macs, but I do know, like, you know, if you open up, when you launch Safari, things come up pretty quick on it, though. Mm-hmm. That's on the A13, I guess, right? Pretty cool. And I guess the other sort of thing that comes along with this, I don't know if you guys have been following, but the Big Sur beta has been in beta for quite a while, and they even have 11.1 now, I think, and it's now in, they're not calling it GM anymore, they're calling it Release Candidate, you know, in keeping with the losing the M word. But yeah, so you can today, as of today, as of recording of November 11th, you can download the profile and get Big Sur 11.1 Release Candidate installed onto your Mac. But I believe it's coming tomorrow, Thursday, officially. So that's another big, I mean, that usually comes with new computers as well, right? So that's cool. And I've been using Big Sur on one of my test machines here for a couple of months, and compared to, you know, on a work machine, and compared to my current work machine, which is Catalina, you know, virtually the same. I've had a few issues with uploading the or updating the beta from one to the other, but that's kind of a minor annoyance. Generally speaking, it's pretty looking thing. I'm running a beta copy of Microsoft Office on it too, with a nice rounded looking, you know, iPad-y kind of interface. Like, it's the edges are smoother and, you know, than they are on Catalina and Mojave. So looks nice and it performs well. I haven't had, like, I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, every time there's a new OS, there's always some sort of little surprise in there. The concern I think I would have for these apps is native compatibility. And in fact, that said, I think a couple of people, and I got one of these emails today too, Apple is, that's another thing too, that I haven't seen on the beta of Big Sur, but you can run iOS apps on the M1s, right? iOS and iPad OS. Apple must be going through testing, because I've gotten an email today, I don't know if you guys have, saying that, you know, some method or whatever is not supported on the M1 in some of my iOS apps, right? So they're obviously going through and testing our apps, compatibility, right? So
for me, it was multi-touch in one of my apps.
Oh, really?
It's not supported on that.
Mm. Multi-touch is the multiple fingers, or?
Yep.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. So one was a sticker pack that we had done, which is really surprising, because, I mean, sticker packs are pretty much just put a bunch of stickers in a folder and images in a folder and publish them, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't do anything special for that particular app. But yeah, I haven't got any more of these, but interesting that these are coming through. I got another one. Live as we see here, does not follow one or more Apple review guidelines. Oh no, my app's been out, which is not surprising considering it's a really old app. I have to go to the resolution center and check this one out. Does not follow App Store review guidelines. Well, how about that? I guess this is another way to cull apps, right? From the App Store?
Yeah, I mean, it effectively ends up having that sort of effect if you're going to need to be multi-architecture, multi-platform.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for this week, so we should get into our picks. What do you think?
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. You thought I was going to end the show there, didn't you? all right, Jaime, you're up first. You got a couple here, right?
Yeah, one is a little bit of an older one. That's the Untold History of macOS System Preferences, which, if you wanted to see what the things look like in macOS 10.2 Jaguar up to, let me see, I have to look at this little GIF. How far did they go? Do they go all the way to? I mean, it's kind of amazing seeing it went from sort of pinstripe, very heavily textured sort of look, and then you get up to Sierra, High Sierra, Mojave, that start losing a lot of that stuff, and Catalina and Big Sur, you can see the big jump in things, and it's kind of nice to see how they've evolved and sort of slowly over time. It wasn't like I ever really noticed that, oh yeah, the keyboard icon looked different, the displays look different, but when you see them next to each other from, you know, version to version, it's very stark and kind of cool and in a nostalgia kind of way.
Yeah, the energy saver one is pretty interesting. It starts with an incandescent light bulb and then moves to a fluorescent. I think now in the last one it's an LED, right? Yeah, which an El Capitan, it switched to an LED lamp light. I think it goes to battery in this one coming in Mojave. Big Big Sur, yeah. Big Sur becomes a battery icon, which is cool. And the mouse also changes along with the different mice that we've had over the year, right? Over the years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when this started, we didn't have infrared mice. We still had mouse balls. Then the magic mice came along, and yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, I, you know, of course, I've lamented or seen all of these various things, and I still have Macs running some of these older OSs too, which is kind of fun. I really liked the beta when it first came out, but of course, it was very, very impractical. Not much ran on it natively. I mean, that's cool. What's your next pick?
Next one is a two-parter. The first one of that part is the YouTube video that is the complete 66 Mac versus PC ads plus Mac and PC WWDC intro and Siri intro. It is sadly not complete. We will talk about that in about 2 minutes. But this one is 38 minutes and 50 seconds of I'm a Mac, I'm a PC ads. And if you had a feeling for nostalgia, you could see those ads and how Apple was positioning itself versus Windows and PCs. And the reason I brought this up is because the one more to complete the set is the, you know, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC thing that has just the PC guy come out and reprise his role in
John Hodgman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for the Apple Silicon event. So I thought that was neat, sort of a blast of the past.
When did that, was that in the actual event itself?
It was at the very tail end, like after the music played. And so we have this link from The Verge where they show John Hodgman there. So they sadly did not bring out Justin Long's character, but it works just as well with John Hodgman, who was sort of the breakout character for what his role is, as the make fun of the PC guy.
Huh, cool.
Yeah.
All right. I'm always looking for courses and stuff like that and interested in how, you know, the sort of the nuts and bolts of working with iOS goes. And one of the things I came across was one of my people at the office reminded me to check out the CS193P course from Stanford University. And I forgot the name of the professor. I almost forget his name. This year is the COVID edition because he's basically, just like most university courses, he's pre-recorded all of the lectures. I'm actually going into lecture 11. They're generally about an hour long. And this year it's all using Swift UI. So he's going through and does a lot of explaining. I mean, he's kind of loosey goosey about the way he talks about generics, but he calls them don't cares. Really informative sort of view of if you spend the time to go through it. It's sometimes a bit of lecture. There's also reading material that goes along with it too. There's like reading for the students, but you can go through these demos and build the apps along with him. Goes quite deep into Swift UI, and you end up learning quite a bit about not just Swift UI, but the whole architecture. The difference is that I'm now doing it using the new app version that we have with Swift UI, where you can build an app as opposed to relying on the app delegate in the previous version. So that was kind of I had to sort of muddle through a few things because I'd not gone down the same path that the course does, but really enjoying the course. And like I said, it's very informative about a lot of different things in, you know, lists and of course the new grid stuff's not in it because it's pre-WWDC content. It's 4 months old, this series of lectures, but good stuff. So I'd highly recommend that if you're curious about, even if you're just getting into Swift UI. I mean, a lot of it's, you know, review for iOS in general, but sort of walks you through all the different bits and pieces you want to do, and you know, and it's using, you know, MVVM, yes, model view model sort of style, so that's good. So it's good for people just getting into iOS, but it's also good for more advanced people too. And the other one here I have is I just came across this today. I came across the other version, but I'm using the clean version, which is the gosh darn Swift UI. I'm not sure if we talked about the gosh darn Swift UI previously. There's a series of these guys, but this has been updated for iOS 14. Siri, did I say Siri? No, I said Swift UI. Go away, Siri. My phone's listening to me. And it does a side by side between UIKit and we did talk about this before. UIKit and the sort of new conventions in Swift UI and a bit of explanation behind it. So it's kind of a good reference guide if you want to get a quick look on what's the difference between Swift UI and UIKit and that kind of stuff. So those are kind of cool. And actually, so just as a bit of an update here, I have an app that I started in 2010 that is written in Objective-C. And a couple of years ago, I started adding some new features to it. So of course, I wrote them in Swift. And this is before the codable was added. So I even have Swifty JSON in there to sort of help me transition. And I decided to put an app clip in it this year. And so the app clip is written completely in Swift UI. So I've got an Objective-C app with Swift in it, and I'm now adding a target, which is written completely in Swift UI, which is kind of cool. Yeah, so that's what I'm up to. So Mark, you have a pick for us?
I do, yeah. So this is a GitHub page called How to Undo Almost Anything with Git.
Undo, okay.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually kind of old as I look at it. It's from 2015. I didn't realize it was that old when I posted it, but it's and we've seen similar things like this before, but I think they're always pretty useful. Just to have all in one place all of the different ways to fix it when you screw up in Git. So it talks about, you know, reset versus revert versus just checkout dash dash. But the one thing that made it kind of interesting that I haven't seen as many places, and I have to admit I've never actually used it, is using the reflog command. And so what reflog is a history of all the times that head in Git terms changed. So, you know, so if you commit something or if you change branches, it keeps a record of all of that stuff in a big list. And using this reflog command, you can actually go in and sort of pick out which commits you might want to keep around and which ones you might want to throw away and revert back to. Kind of interesting extra tool in your toolbox next time you screw up in Git.
Yeah, I've used amend a few times. Obviously, especially depending on your CI, you may have your continuous integration system. You may have a requirement to like for Jira, right? You have the Jira ticket in there, and if you forget to put that in there, a lot of newbies do. There's a way to go in and amend, change the comment, right?
Change the commit message. Yep.
Yeah.
You gotta be careful with that kind of stuff, though. Yeah. If you've already pushed, well, like anything else, if you've already pushed it up to somewhere remote, then be careful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. But there's a lot of times people get jammed, and I mean, sometimes you get so badly messed up, you just go back and open a new branch and cherry pick your changes and, you know, forget about the previous one, right?
Yep. Yeah. Cool. This is actually really good because it goes off of here's what the command it is. What is it that you have done that is horribly wrong or that you would like to redo? And it's like undo a public change or, you know, reset local changes. Like I've seen some of these that are like, oh, here's all these commands and here's what you might be supposed to, I don't even know where to start. This one starts from here is the problem, how to resolve the problem, which I like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Cool. All right, cool. Hey, before we go, we didn't talk about HomeBot Mini. What do you guys, yes, no, would you buy one?
So I really like the idea. I haven't bought one yet, and I might buy a couple of them, but I'm a little disappointed that they're not particularly interoperable with the HomePod itself.
Oh, they're not?
Yeah. Now, I wouldn't expect you to be able to, you know, do a stereo pairing with a full-size HomePod and a HomePod Mini because they're such, you know, different hardware, you know, that it would be hard for them to match each other. But I would have liked to have seen more integration in terms of, you know, can I make some cool, like, surround sound thing? And of course you can by placing them yourself and figuring out how to do it yourself.
Yeah.
But I would have liked to have seen some software solution where you can hook these all up together. They're all aware of each other and they are adjusting each other's sounds to optimize the whole set of them. And you can't do that right now.
Right,
you can stereo pair to HomePod Minis or you can stereo pair to HomePods, but you can't mix and match.
So there, you still can't do the quadraphonic Dark Side of the Moon yet?
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you can if you buy four.
Well, can
buy
you?
Four of either one.
I did the stereo pair once with the two HomePods I have here. Yeah, that's disappointing. So can you buy two minis and make them stereo pairs?
You can. Oh, okay. Yes, you can.
Yeah, I think
presumably there'll be a future software update that does this. I'm guessing.
Yeah, and there's also there's the new broadcast thing, which I know you live by yourself, but there's the Amazon Echoes do this where you can you know, basically call like an intercom system in your house.
The intercom. Yeah. Yep, yep.
And apparently you can do that now with not just, I don't think it's just the iPod or the HomePods, it's also available to your other devices as well, which is cool.
With that, you can mix and match between the HomePod and the HomePod Mini. That is true.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Yep. That's cool.
Yep, yep.
All right. What about you, Jaime? Would you buy one? Or
I did not. I have just
Alexa family.
I have just the one HomePod, and my place isn't really big enough to warrant having more of these, but I can totally agree with Mark's point that it hypothetically could be like a Dolby Atmos setup where you've got like five or six different devices that are all working as one in order to provide a really complete whole room experience. I mean, that'd be really cool if you could do that.
Yeah.
But the price is just about right. I think they just about nailed it for what this would be. It's never going to be the, you know, Friday after Black Friday after Thanksgiving, you know, $25, get a whole six pack of them sort of thing, like the way the Amazon Echo Dots would be. But it was it $199? I think that's a reasonable price. You might get that without up feeling like you're investing too much.
But that's for two. They're $99.
Oh, that's right. It is $99. That's right. Sorry. It's been a while since that event. You're right. At $99, it's even better.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you could see them, you know, well, I guess it depends on how much in demand they are, but you could see them on special for $75 or something like that at some point. That's possible.
Right. Yeah. Well, since we're talking about sound here, just circling back to the MacBook Pro M1, has a stereo speakers with high dynamic range difference, and also has a studio quality mic. It's about three mics, actually, compared to the Air. So if you're an audiophile and you want to make yourself sound really good on your Zoom calls, then you might want to think about the Pro.
If you're that into audio, though, you probably have a standalone mic.
That's true.
That's my guess.
For sure.
But maybe you don't need one in this.
Maybe you don't. So, how much RAM did I buy in this Mac? All right, well, I guess that's it for this week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
All right, Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm still at markr@smapsoft.com.
All right, and as I say...
I had to think about that for a minute.
Really?
It's been a while.
As I say every week, my name is Tim Mitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bad. Didn't seem like there was too much rust there. I'm serious. It wasn't bad.
Jaime and I are professionals. We still do this. We do this every week, right?
It is a very different show, though. It is very different. I have to sort of think about, wait, what do we have in this show? Mm. We have fact check, follow up. Okay, we don't have headlines. Mm. We have main topics.
The same thing, really. Yeah.
It's structurally very similar, but the way things happen is different.
Yeah. Well, that one, we don't have to move things around. Like the after show doesn't come from the before show and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So we had the coldest day of the year on Sunday here.
Really?
Yep. And that was, of course, the day my furnace decided to die.
Oh, nice. So what's the deal with that? You got to get a new one or you got to get it fixed? Or?
Well, here's the weird thing. So it died on Wednesday and I called the guy and he said he'd come today. Sorry, called on Sunday. It died on Sunday. And so the guy said he could come today. So I haven't had heat since Sunday. Luckily, it warmed up a little bit, but Sunday and Monday were kind of cold.
How cold was it like?
It was in the 30s at night.
Okay, I don't know. I have to do the math on that one.
So 32 is zero.
Oh, zero, right. Yeah. Really, that cold, so eh?
Yeah, it was cold. Yeah, wow. Yeah, it was cold.
Yeah, because we've had unseasonably warm. I mean, it's like summer today. Like it's, you know, summer weather, like 70s right now, right, for us.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, it's, you know, we've got a lot of work done. We had our snow tires put on today, so we're kind of taunting the gods, right?
Yeah. So the guy came today and he said, oh, it's just this, you know, the code was at this, you know, this limit switch, which is basically if it gets too hot, it trips.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Right.
He said that just got stuck and he fixed it. And he's like, okay, it's done. No problem.
Right.
And then as he's getting ready to leave, it happened again.
Oh, well, okay.
So he's like, oh, that's strange. So he's going through, he's checking everything, you know, he's checking the vents, he's checking the, you know, he's turning down the gas flow, you know, and he at the end, he's like, I don't know why this is happening. It's just happening and I can't fix it. So I'm not going to charge you. I suggest you call someone else.
So yeah, you know, it's weird. It's just like that's like the thing that I had starting in 2017, right? With like Christmas, it just stopped working, and then I you yeah. know if it was like if it got to like minus like our furnace room was not heated, right? Like we actually mm-hmm. we were convinced to use cold air from outside and blah blah blah. So we never bothered insulating that room. So if it got to like if it got colder than -5 outside Celsius, then mm-hmm. the furnace mm-hmm. would fire. But if it got warmer, it wouldn't fire, right? Mm. And then so that was the first sort of weirdness. And then I found that after a while, I found that if I because like it would be just sort of I'd just take a crack at it, and if I'd look at the weather outside, it would work for like a day or so, and then it would just stop, right? And then a couple of a few months later, I was dicking around with it, and I was checking out the you know I was going online you know reading about you know how to check furnaces and stuff like that, because the guys came in, they put a new pressure switch in, and that didn't do F all, right? I ended up putting that old pressure switch back in because I'd rather have the original one, right? And so I found that if I pulled the circuit board forward, if I pulled the, like where the board was forward, it would fire. So I used like some duct tape to hold it forward for a month or so, and then the duct tape would eventually get hot and warm, and you know it would go back.
Yeah.
So then I put
yeah.
a little piece of 2x4 behind it, little you know 3-inch square, and that worked for like a year, you know. And then it just it stopped in March. Like it just finally gave up in March. And so I, you know, went through, I bought a new board. I still have the board here. I should go on Amazon and sell it, because I bought a board to replace the one I had. And I finally got, you know, I thought, well, let me take the board out and look at the board, right? So I've ended up undoing the board that's kind of clipped, it's held in with clips, and I flipped it over upside down, and there was a big burn mark in the back of it, because it had blown out where the fan motor control was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the furnace guy that came in and helped me, there was one furnace guy who, he's the guy we ended up hiring to put our new furnace in and all that kind of stuff, because he's the only person who texted me immediately as soon as I said I had a problem, right? And he's always like, here, try this and try that, whatever. One time he's in Florida, he did a FaceTime call with me holding the
wow.
the camera up to the furnace and the whole bit, right? So you know, of course, when it came to getting quotes and stuff like that, I said, we're going to get that guy to quote too, because he's the only guy I trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, after all that I've been through, like 3 years of troubleshooting with him, right? And, you know, because we were making do, we had like, but we bought like a whole bunch of those oil. They're basically look like little radiators, but they've got oil in them, and they heat up and they maintain the heat, and they're much more efficient in terms of like electric heat, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, we have like 5 of them or something like that, ridiculous now. And this year for air conditioning, we bought like 3. We have 3 of those, you know, portable air conditioner things, you know, with the hose that goes out the window. So mm-hmm. yeah, so what he told me was it was probably because I was bending the board, I was actually making the connection, right?
Mm.
And that also explains why when it got hot and cold, it was actually closing the circuit, you know, so that the power would run, right? So now, I don't know. I'd look at your board if I were you.
Here's the funny thing.
Yeah.
Since the guy left, it's been working perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, go figure. Like so. Yeah. But I've had things like there's a because we deal with, I think, furnaces. I'm going to say we deal with furnaces more than you guys do, but I guess that may not be true, right? Because you get used to the temperature around. But there's a sensor in there. If you don't clean your filters out, it'll overheat, right?
But that's what this was.
That's a sensor that gets burned out, yeah. and you have to replace yeah. that. I've had that replaced a couple of times, and there was another one yeah. that
I do kind of wonder if once it gets cold again, if I'm going to have the same problem. You know, it's yeah. only because
yeah.
now that it's warmed up a little bit, the furnace still runs, but there's something about when it's really cold outside and has to run extra hard,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Then it's having the problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we ended up buying we had a Train furnace before, and we went and we all these people quoted us on these different things, and it turns out they're all pretty much there's like seems to be a few of them that are made. They just put different labels on them. In fact, we ended up buying an American Standard furnace, but it looks identical to a Train, right? The only difference is it says American Standard on the front. Like, I mean, like, you know, on the Train commercials, you look at the furnace and it's literally our furnace. Like,
yeah.
it's like, you know, like the difference between a Pontiac and a Buick, you know, kind of thing.
What does it cost to replace a furnace? Is it like $5,000? Something like that?
Yeah, a little bit less. I mean, well, in Canadian dollars, I mean, we paid $13 altogether, but that included a tankless water heater and a new air conditioner as well. So we got a condenser for outside.
That seems pretty cheap.
That's Canadian too, right? So that's like, what, $50 American, right?
Yeah. I can't believe it would be that cheap here. I just don't.
Yeah.
I just can't believe it.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. So the one thing I found, yeah, and it's funny that there's one good guy. I'll put a link in the show notes. One good guy on, I think he's from, I want to say, he's in the Midwest somewhere, right? And he's a young guy, and he goes through how to troubleshoot a furnace, how to troubleshoot a blower, how to all the sort of the 10 things that goes on. There's one episode he does where his top 10 service related things with furnaces, right? Mm-hmm. And he keeps a list for a year, and he basically marks down how many times he gets called for these particular things, right? And then he rates them, so he does the top 10 of all of the the 30 different symptoms that he's dealt with over the year, right? But so the video he does the top 10, and then just for bonus he goes through the rest of the list and talks about the fixes for all these, like, it's just like everything you ever want to know about furnaces we're afraid to ask, right? I'll tell you though, what I have learned about furnaces, they are just big barbecues with a big fan motor, pretty much.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of safeties, right? I mean, admittedly, right? Like, you don't want to blow your house up or burn it down, right? But yeah, they're not that sophisticated, really, you know?
Oh, is it gas? Is your gas or is it yours?
Ours is gas. Yeah, ours is gas. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if, an electric furnace, I would have no trouble going in there and just mucking around with
it. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But a gas one, you kind of don't want to muck around.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, the thing about it is I can't touch the gas side. In fact, we're not allowed to in Canada. Like, you have to be a gas fitter to do anything, even to buy parts or whatever. But
yeah, because even if you don't blow yourself up, you set something wrong and the carbon monoxide level goes up die in your sleep that night, right?
Well, we have carbon monoxide sensors on our alarm system and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
Too. Yeah. But I even ended up taking the blower motor out this year to try and, because that was one of the things, is maybe the blower motor is burned out. So I've got a blower motor from Amazon and I pulled the whole unit out, and this guy's video showed how to basically wire it up so you could actually plug it into the wall and just run it like on regular AC and see what the problem was, right? And so I had the blower motor in my bathroom, blowing a house worth of air around in the bathroom. It was like being in a windstorm, right? Mm. But yeah, just to check it out, and it turned out there was nothing wrong with the motor, nothing wrong with the blower motor. So I ended up putting it back, even though I put the new one in from Amazon in, and then I took this one out, put it back in, and yeah. So I've taken my furnace apart completely, right down to nothing this year, and put it back together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we just finally resigned and just went and got a brand new system, right? Make ourselves sane. We started this conversation, Jaime, is it's this time it was Mark's furnace that died.
Yeah, but it actually didn't die. It just,
it's doing what mine did, which
needed to rest for a while, I guess.
Yeah. When I was a wee lad, I remember, playing the Nintendo Entertainment System, NES, with my cousins. And after a couple of hours of playing, your parents would come in and say, hey, you need to let it rest. You need to let it rest. You go outside.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it was just an excuse, but I don't actually factually know if maybe it does need to rest, given that apparently furnaces do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our furnace died after it was probably 17 years, because I think we put it in 2000, right, when we redid our basement. And so we got more years out of it than we should have. And I mean, admittedly, but the furnace we had before that was 35 years old. So I mean,
I bought this house 22 years ago, and this furnace was already there.
Oh, really? You bought it secondhand? It was not a new house.
New house?
Like, was it brand new, like a new construction house when you moved in?
No. It was definitely not. No.
Yeah.
Nobody bought. Well, some people do, but in Canada, most people buy houses new.
Some
people do.
Well, so the thing about it is, okay, so the Greater Toronto Area, it's getting to be a little bit like LA in terms of the amount of houses and stuff around and how far it sprawls, right? Because, all the houses, when I first moved in with Carol 20 years ago or 30 years ago, there was a lot of farms north of Toronto, right? And all of those are now filled in with suburbs, right? And then there's suburbs going all the way up to Barrie, up to the lakes, whatever. So, I would think a lot of people are moving out to the suburbs to new housing. It's not like, I guess the GTA area is a little bit like the valley where you are, right? But you know how you can go from one, it's pretty much like one continuous city from one to the other. Like you and I have driven there before, and it's like, yeah, they have different names and stuff, but it's like streets with houses on it, right?
Right.
There's no sort of, there's a few spots where there's as you go up the highway, there's a lot of empty space, but here in Toronto, it's pretty much, yeah, it's pretty much all houses all the time kind of thing now. Like when we used to drive to the cottage, you know, there'd be a lot of, or the first, you know, third of the drive would be houses, and then it would be, you'd be in like, you know, wilderness with trees and whatever, right? But now 2/3 of the way up to the cottage is just houses, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, over the last 30 years or so. So there's a lot of, so yeah, I think a lot of people at condos go up like crazy here in Toronto, right? So I think a lot of people like the smell of new drywall and primer, I guess, you know, off gassing from tile glue and whatever.
Yeah, I guess it's different here because there's very little space left to build new things.
Yeah, that's true. And your houses don't necessarily like crumble and fall down like ours do, right? Like you're not, I mean, you're relatively moderate climate, right?
Yeah, that's for sure true. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, our cars rust.
So do houses in Canada just kind of fall down? Randomly?
No, not really. Not really. But I mean, there's a lot of construction. I mean, how neighborhoods get gentrified, as we call it, right? Like our neighborhood mm-hmm. went through a real sort of gentrification, you know, where people mm-hmm. come in and they take down the old, you know, like my house is built in 1910, so it has a, you know, old 1910 facade, but people take the fronts off and change the port, you know, change them, and some of them burn down and they put up new ones with just brick,
yeah,
you know,
that's true. Yeah.
Whatever. But yeah, there's a lot of, and some of them look like bloody architects designed them last week, you know, even they've been all, you know, dolled up, right? So yeah, I don't know. There's houses here in my neighborhood that are like, you know, hundreds of years old, but you know, there are houses that a lot of people live in that are, you know, built in the 70s, built in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, you know. Lots of new construction going on.